the best tool ever devised for understanding how the world works.
Science is a vacuum for knowledge. We are always at the brink of the node.
Science is a collaborative enterprise spanning the generations. We remember those who prepared the way, seeing through them also.
If you're scientifically literate, the world looks very different to you, and that understanding empowers you.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
We can do science, and with it, we can improve our lives.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
The story of humans is a story of ideas that shine light into dark corners.
Scientists love mysteries. They love not knowing.
I don't feel frightened by not knowing things. I think it's much more interesting.
There's a larger universal reality of which we are all a part.
The further we probe into the universe, the more remarkable are the discoveries we make.
The quest for the truth in and of itself is a story that's filled with insights.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
We can do science, and with it, we can improve our lives.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
The story of humans is a story of ideas that shine light into dark corners.
From our lonely point in the cosmos, we have, through the power of thought, been able to peer back to a brief moment after the beginning of the universe.
I think that science changes the way your mind works, to think a little more deeply about things.
Science replaces private prejudice with publicly verifiable evidence.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
We can do science, and with it, we can improve our lives.
It's time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
This is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist and amateur magician.
And this is Daniel, president of the UBC Freethinkers Club and economics student here at UBC.
As skeptics, we utilize the scientific method to test claims. And I thought it'd be interesting to sort of discuss why. Why do we rely on science, the scientific method, as skeptics to look at?
Maybe we should clarify a bit. What is our definition of the scientific method?
This is a good point. Some people differ in their definitions. A sort of working definition, in, I guess, layman's terms, is that the scientific method comes up first with observations about the world. So we make some observation, in this case, oh, when I wear this copper bracelet, my pain seems to go away. Then we go into a hypothesis, how this could happen, to explain the observations we're making. Well, wearing this copper bracelet ionizes the air somehow, and this helps with my pain. Then we test this claim. And therein lies the core of the scientific method. Experimentation, carefully designed experiments to test claims. And when you test the claim, you get data and you discover through various means, usually statistical, whether there is an effect or not. And you repeat the process.
I think it's important to note that when you're doing the experiment, you're not going in trying to prove something.
Exactly.
You don't want to bias yourself from the beginning, right?
You're coming in without an expectation as the result. I mean, sometimes your hypothesis will propose a positive effect, but you're not coming in trying to get a positive effect. You're coming in to see what is actually happening.
Yeah. And sometimes the hypothesis is completely off. Sometimes it's right on. But the goal is to see what happens.
And I think one of the things, too, that's very important with this is in Rob's sort of fictitious trying to explain how copper ones would work. You know, he said something to do with the ions or whatever. You could say, if you wanted to, well, if I wear this copper bracelet, it attracts pixies. And pixies go into your blood and they take out all the bad ooglies. And that's how it cures it. Well, now you say, okay, well, now try and test it. Well, we don't know what pixies are, if they exist. We don't know what ooglies are. How do they do it? Yeah, so it becomes an untestable claim. And that's the other aspect of the scientific method, is it creates a way to test claims. There's lots of people who make these bizarre claims about one thing or another, but they do it with totally unfounded, unrealistic, or just made up hypotheses that are untestable. And as soon as it becomes untestable, it can't be scientifically proven. Therefore, its validity becomes deeply in question.
It can't be scientifically proven. It can't even be scientifically tested. That's what untestable means.
The method basically rules out magic. That's what we're getting at. And not to say that as skeptics, we have to be open-minded that maybe magic exists. We can't test it, though. And at
it depends on how you define the effects of magic.
Well, yeah.
Basically, if you're saying that something has a measurable effect on something, then it can, in principle, be tested.
Right.
If you say that it has an effect, but that it can't be tested, you are doing something else.
I mean, anybody can make a claim. That's easy to do. But make a claim that is provable, that is consistent. That's where the money is.
Yeah.
And reproducible as well. That maybe you can prove it, but somebody in Tokyo can also prove it.
This is also a large function of science. The results have to be replicable and actually replicated before they can be accepted as, you know, provisionally true.
Would you consider something like Occam's razor to be part of that? And Occam's razor is that you remove as many extraneous bits of information as possible to still maintain the viability of your sentence. So we'll go back with Rob's explanation about ions. He says, yes, there are ions, but the ions come out of the butts of pixies, which live in copper. Well, you could still have a testable claim by saying the ions, and you could drop the pixie bit.
Yeah, given the option between two theories in the absence of evidence supporting one or the other, you're going to want to pick the one that is in some ways more elegant or at least easier to deal with. And that's the one with less entities to test.
And when you add
I would go for just ions as opposed to ions and pixies.
Well, and when you add the entities, these extra things, those also eventually become things you have to somehow prove. And that's where you get some of the really bizarre, because you can sit there and you can find something that is a genuinely reproducible claim. But then people go in and post hoc go in there and say, okay, well, this is true and it's part of natural things, but it's part of quantum theory. And because we have quantum theory, that means all our minds are connected in a universal consciousness. And you go, wait a minute.
I think that was the thesis of what the bleep do we know?
Yes.
Well, I guess it's also a process of trying to explain the most by making the least amount of assumptions.
Exactly. So when you have to assume that more stuff exists than you need,
yeah,
you're sort of violating this principle.
And of course, the classic example, you know, where did the universe come from? Well, if you say the universe has always existed, okay, you need to prove the universe exists. Does the universe exist? Yes, the universe exists. Now, someone says, okay, yes, but you needed something to create the universe. We need God. So now they have two things. One, you need the universe. Does it exist? Knock, knock. Yes, it does. Now you have to prove God. And you go, well, do you really need this extra entity? Does it add anything to the whole story? And if it does, then you have to prove the existence. And if you can't do that, then what's the point? Occam's razor slices off the head of God, and we're back to real Europe.
And on the topic of the word proof, proof is sort of a sticky subject in science, philosophy, and skepticism. We don't mean prove as like logically necessary, which runs into a lot of problems, but prove in the sense that it's more likely to be true than not.
You're kind of raising the percentage of it being true. You're never going to get to like 100%, maybe one day, but you want to get up there into the upper 90s.
Yeah. I think it was David Hume who created this maxim in his philosophical treatise on, I think it was Essay Concerning Human Understanding, where he said that I will only accept a miraculous claim as true, and I'm paraphrasing him here, if it is less miraculous to deny the evidence for it, more miraculous to deny the evidence for it than to accept it. The sort of idea where it would be far more sensible to accept it as being true than to deny it and also deny all the evidence in favor of it.
Right. Which, of course, just goes in with Carl Sagan's, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof.
To put it in
miraculous claims require miraculous proof. One of the things that, and we were talking about this between breaks here, one of the things that really, really gets me really upset is this whole idea that there are scientific truths and there are religious truths or moral truths.
Things that, you know, that might not be true for you, but it's true for me.
You know, and no, I mean, true is true. Philosophically, you might say there are no truths, and that's a valid claim, but there is one kind of truth. Something is either true or it's not truth. Otherwise, it's just belief. And beliefs are valid, but they're only beliefs, they're opinion.
And the idea that scientists take is that something is provisionally true. So you assume it's true because it's supported by enough evidence to assume that it is true. And this is sort of the method that skeptics have taken and are trying to apply to things that might not necessarily be within the realm of usual scientific study. So this could apply to things that are not within the realm of scientific study because the scientific culture hasn't accepted them as actual fields of study yet. Things like paranormal activities.
Or cryptozoology or Atlantis or something.
Things that are considered to be outside of science because they are religious claims, the existence of gods, etc. And so we take this idea that, okay, we are not going to assume it's true unless we see some good evidence.
And that doesn't mean that we're in the hyper-skeptic thing. It's not like, you know, you haven't proved to me that aliens exist, therefore aliens can't exist. I'm quite willing to say that there might be aliens out there. In fact, I believe there probably are aliens. I doubt they visited Earth. That is a belief, because there's no way I can prove it. There's no way you can prove it. Skeptics can still believe in things that are not 100% proven to be true.
Yeah, it's more the view that it's okay to say, I don't know, and to assume neither truth or untruth until you've actually taken a look at it carefully.
I think that's why we kind of get so worked up over claims that simply cannot function when you apply the scientific method to them. Things like homeopathy or the anti-vax movement. And the reason we sort of get so upset is because these claims, people who make them claim they're absolutely true, but under reasonable scientific conditions, they don't hold up. And I think that applies to, you know, we talked about the Shroud of Turin recently. We've talked about copper bracelets. And if you're going to make a claim, we think that it should have what we just mentioned, like the scientific method should be able to support it. And it clearly doesn't.
And the reason we want it to be supported by the scientific method is because that is pretty much the best method we have for testing the veracity of a claim.
It's a yardstick. And I mean, you need to have certain yardsticks. One of the great things about science so far, and who knows, maybe the aliens will come and show us some other thing that we don't know of. But the great thing about science as we know it today is its ability to be self-correcting. And that, in a sense, is the quantum leap over other previous methods. Is because when you had proofs in the old sense of the way, the old truths, they were dogmatic. They were true because they were written down or someone said they were true, and they were true forever and ever and ever.
There was this no idea of progress.
Right. Whereas scientific truths, they sit there and say, okay, well, we believe this, but we're going to keep testing it because there may be something we've missed, or there may be something more there than we don't know about, and it self-corrects over time. Which is why, you know, so many people criticize science, especially in the creationist community, among others, who say, well, you got this wrong, and they think it's a fault, but it's a strength. It's the fact that we found out it was wrong, and we've corrected for it. That's the strength of scientific.
That's not the weakness. That's the biggest strength of science. I mean, people are always saying to me, well, you scientists used to believe the world was flat. Well, first of all, that's a historic myth anyway. People, no one believed that. But anyway, even if they did, it got corrected. You know, we actually have an open mind. We can change our minds. If you're religious, not to pick on religion, but you're pretty much stuck with what they tell you. You can't rewrite the Bible or any other religious text. You're kind of stuck with what you have. Science can change its mind.
That's why skepticism and science go together like two peas in a pod.
Exactly.
So I think
or any other kind of like twin cloning type thing.
Yes.
As skeptics, there's actually a moral responsibility, I think, on all of us to become informed, to go out there and to confront the fallacies, the lies, or at least expose the quackery that's out there. I think it's important for skeptics to go out and to confront these things, to say, listen, no, this isn't true. To tell your friends, listen, this isn't true and this is why it's not true. Skepticism is a belief system, but it should also be almost a movement. It should be, we were talking before the show about on TV, about how many skeptics, really skeptics, shows, how many real science shows are out there. And for every Mythbusters, which I'm going to count as a science show for the moment, for every Mythbusters out there, there's at least five Ghost Hunter shows out there.
Paranormal mysteries, unsolved mysteries, UFO report.
You know, and in the History Channel or Nova, you know, they have Jesus Discovered or whatever, right? You know, and all these things which are pseudoscience at worst, or they're sensationalized. And part of the skeptic community needs to do is you need to go out there, you need to be more visible, you need to be more aggressive in being out there. Don't, you know, find your local chiropractor and beat him up. Don't do something like that. That's not the kind of thing. But go out there and say, listen, you're promoting that if I get my back aligned, that's somehow going to cure the flu. How can you make such a claim?
Be activists is what we're saying.
Hold people accountable. Get out there ask people to show evidence.
Don't be afraid to say what you're saying is completely BS, especially if there's any something like vaccines are harmful or that a copper bracelet is going to save your life, because it's just not. And you could be saving someone's life. So be activists out there.
We are your skeptic radio show. We're here to help represent you. Send us your feedback. We want to hear from you. We want to know what you're thinking. Send us your email. Send us your comments. And we will do the kind of show that everyone wants to hear, to be your voice on the air, promoting, advocating for skepticism.
That's well said, Don. So, Jennifer, you gave a really interesting talk at the TEDx Terry Talks here at UBC called Wonder and Science.
Sorry, TEDx Terry. What's TEDx Terry? Maybe Jennifer can tell us what TEDx Terry is to begin with, and then tell us about your talk.
Sure. Okay, I'll start from the TED side of things. So TED is a conference that happens once a year, and it brings together people from all over the world, from all different disciplines, who are doing interesting things. And the basis is really just to share ideas, and those ideas are shown up on videos online, and they're released every week. So UBC does a version of this that's called TEDx. So it's an independently organized TED event. And so they call it TEDx Terry Talks because they have a website and a collection of other science communication and communication ideas that are called Terry. So that's how they brought that together. So that is what the Terry Talk is.
I'm quite sure our website will have links to both the TED site and the TEDx Terry site for people who want to investigate some of the videos.
And watch Jennifer's talk. So what motivated you to give a talk at this TEDx Terry?
It was such an interesting, the TEDx format is such an interesting format because it's really just sharing ideas. So I really wanted to go out there and just share a little bit about what I've been doing and what I think is important for people to think about as they go along. So I talked about sharing wonder, and I based that around, or I talked about communicating science, and I based it around wonder because I thought it was really important. I'm noticing this as I get older and as I move further out of school, that it's really important to find wonder in your day. And I find that it's really exciting to find wonder if I look through the world through the eyes of science. So that's how I kind of went about my talk, is that I thought about what are some interesting things that I find really absolutely fascinating in science, and how does that make me feel? How can I use that to bring science to other people? And then, of course, I find it, there's a lot of, there still needs to be work, and there always will need to be work in communicating science to the public, because the language that scientists use is often quite inaccessible on a regular everyday basis, but there are ways to bring in that language and make it accessible.
I know we were talking here a couple of shows back about people like Carl Sagan and all that, and how their work was to take, you know, the magnificence of science and the wonder of science and try and instill that into people. Is that the kind of thing you're getting at? Is that you see all these wonderful things and you want the common people, for lack of a better word, to see it? What would be a good word here?
The non-scientist?
Just the non-scientist, I think I would say, because there's the scientists, and then there's people like me who are interested in science, but I don't have a science background, per se, so the non-scientist. I think that's exactly it. I think there are so many really interesting things that happen in science, but when it's hidden behind a 10-word long titled paper that 8 of the words you don't have a clue what they are because they're not used in everyday language, it becomes really inaccessible as to what it is that they're talking about. But there are so many things that are interesting. I mean, at Triumph, there's a lot of interesting things that we do. We're working we're working on a project with LHC at CERN, and they're looking for the Higgs boson, which is, if they find it, may explain how mass exists and how gravity works and how everything kind of fits together. So,
going on what you were just talking there about the Large Hadron Collider, and what you were just saying about the difficulties in presenting science in the media, we talked earlier about it's not easy to give a complicated, accurate definition of what's going on in science in a newspaper, because the headline often is, Large Hadron Collider is going to destroy the universe.
Or my,
tiny black holes or some other oversimplification.
Or the one I hate is that they're going to discover the God particle. And you go, how is it the God particle? You know, but it's a short, catchy...
The particle with a beard.
Yes.
So what are some of the challenges that you've encountered trying to, explain what is a really fascinating piece of technology without scaring people to think a black hole is going to swallow them?
I think on the media side, which is what I'll start with, is that it's kind of, there has to be, definitely in journalism, when you're writing a story, there has to be a beginning and an end, and there has to be some sort of conclusion. But in science, there really aren't any specific conclusions very often. You know, they'll get to a conclusion at one point, and then maybe in 10, 15, 50 years from now, that conclusion can be overturned. And scientists know that. So they don't want to say that they have found the discovery or they have found the answer, because they know that at some point in the future they could be overturned. And that's just the way that science works. That's how discoveries get made, because there is the potential that this might not be the absolute answer. This is the best that we know right now, but it's not the absolute answer. So that is where where it doesn't fit into the journalism model, where the journalists want an answer and they want something specific, but the scientists can't actually give them the answer. I think that's where a lot of the tension within the stories come from, and the misinformation. That's one point of where how stories could be written different, just to explain that, yes, science doesn't exactly have an end, but it's something that we're in the process of discovering.
Excellent.
So where does the responsibility lie? Is it with the journalist to make sure that they inform the reader that science is tentative, or is it with the scientist who is supposed to make sure that the readers understand that this position might change and that how this article seems really firm is not actually true?
I think really it's both sides. There's a lot of responsibility on both sides. I think when the journalists are talking to the scientists, they can't be scared to say that they don't understand something and really just ask over and over again to make sure that they're understanding it. And it's also their responsibility to send it back to the scientists to ensure that what they have written is correct as much as it can be. But it's also important for the scientists to realize that the journalist isn't going to be able to put absolutely everything in the story, and all the details aren't going to get in there. So as long as it's not an untruth of what they're writing, that would be a good thing. And just to have a little bit more relaxation in knowing that they're not going to be quoted. They're not going to be able to put everything in the article that they would want, but just enough so people understand.
Going on, and we talked about this a little before the show, and this kind of relates when we were talking about the God particle or the CERN will create black holes. Newspapers, magazines, even online stuff, they're in it to make money, you know, as when it comes right down to it. So there's a certain tension that also comes between the need of the journalist or the editor or whomever in the magazine part to not worry so much about the details of the article, scientific discovery, but try and tart it up, make it flashier, make it, you know, so again, like we were talking before, and you get scientists cure cancer or broccolis will kill you, and then you go into the study and there's so much nuance, you know, in one rat or whatever they cured one form of glaucoma or something, and when you get into the meat of it, it's not there. But in order to sell the paper, journalists or newspapers will, like I say, tart up the headlines, and that adds another level, because not only do you have the worry of completeness and the start, the middle, the end, but the aims of the scientists versus the aims of the people publishing what the scientists have sometimes can be contrary.
I think that is, well, I think there's a couple aspects to it. I think that is on the journalist's plate to think about what they're doing. And I think that there's a lot of tools that are available to them with the written word, with photographs, with videos, that they can go in and actually tell the story around that science. So maybe even if it seems that the science is dry, maybe they can actually pull a story out of that research and be like, oh, so how did you come across this? Can you tell me a little bit more about yourself, and wrap that around the story, so that they can actually say something interesting that works really well in print that will engage the readers, but the information can be put inside of that as well, where it doesn't necessarily need to be just the facts. There can be the human element to it as well. On the other hand, newspapers are going through a difficult time right now where there are layoffs and cutbacks, and journalists don't have the time, so it is stressful for the journalists to go out there and try to find that story. But if they go into an interview maybe looking for that angle and looking for that side of it, maybe they'll come across it just haphazardly, and then be like, okay, so maybe I can put this in the article, and that will make it interesting.
So that's why you see, I've noticed in a lot of modern documentaries, and this is probably going back a little bit, you get like Big Brother Lab, you know, where you have the scientist doing his discovery, whatever he's working on, but then they go, here he is at home, and this is how he got to wherever he's doing his experiments, and the troubles and tribulations they have to bring out the human side of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's not just science that they have to bring out the human side of the story, but it is a very thin, it's just a wonderful tool, because, I mean, we're all human, and that's how we communicate to each other. We communicate to each other with stories, and we want to know, I mean, we gossip to each other. We want to know what's going on, right?
Well, one thing that we were sort of talking about is there is something of you mentioned sort of an economic problem right now, and it is affecting newspapers, I think not just because of the current economic climate, but just because of the rise of the blog sphere.
You mean economic problem as in newspapers are folding all the time, they're cutting back in journalist staff?
Exactly, right?
I remember seeing an infographic that showed how many subscribers newspapers had, and after 2001, I believe, there was a sharp rise in the number of people that were posting videos onto YouTube, or 2003 maybe, and you see this incredibly steep decline in the number of subscribers to places like, you know, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, these massive newspapers that have to deal with blogs and YouTube and the idea of citizen journalism. And
actually, I find it even bizarre, because one of the smaller newspapers where they get killed is the classified. I didn't quite realize this, but a lot of them make their money on the classified ads. Who'd have thunk it? But you get things like Craigslist and eBay and all these other things where people can sell themselves for free without putting out that newspaper. But anyhow, so newspapers are under economic stress.
Classified section into the science section. So you get blogs, right? And you get the good ones like Phil Platon, you know, us. But the thing is, we're not journalists. We don't go through journalism school. We don't have journalistic integrity. So what is this dichotomy going to give us? We're going to have understaffed newspapers with maybe one science editor versus a blog sphere of amateurs. What challenges does this give us for purporting science accurately?
The one thing that I think is interesting as this is happening is because, I mean, there's gonna have to be some new economic model that's going to replace how newspapers are working right now. Not newspapers, but how they're functioning. And what I think is interesting right now is that even though newspapers are going under all over the place, people are still relying on the news as a source of information. People do go to blogs, and they do go to YouTube, and they do go to all of these other places, but I think when it comes down to it, I mean, I still go to BBC, I still go to Open Mail, you know, I still go to those places because I know that there is some level of checking going on, and it's habit, right? I mean, we all go to the newspapers because we trust that someone has been looking through this for us. But on the other hand, I mean, there's so much good reporting going on in blogs as well that there still needs to be some sort of checks and balances. And I think that will just come out of what's happening naturally because people want that. They want to know that the information that they're reading is correct or at least true in some sense. People don't like being swindled. That's what it comes down to. That's human nature, too.
Excellent.
That's another thing that we brought up, but we were talking about before the show, is one of the things about journalistic creed, and I don't know if it would even occur in the blogosphere, but the idea of trying to be fair and balanced, right? I mean, it's a joke on Fox Network, but journalists often try and present, you know, both sides of the argument, but with science news and science articles, sometimes that dichotomy doesn't hold true. I mean, there are a certain degree between some things are scientifically true and there's not really a debate about it, or they're objectively true, whatever that might mean.
Yeah, we sort of worry about bringing legitimacy to anti-science movements like the creationists or climate denialists or anti-vaccinationists, which we've talked about on the show a lot before, and how, you know, journalists sometimes bring both sides up and present them as equally valid. I'm not sure if that's actually the case, but sometimes it seems like when the journalist is seeking to present both sides of a story, it serves to legitimize a side of the story that is going against evidence or ignoring it, when a science journalist should really be focusing on, well, this side is supported by evidence and this side is kind of crackpotty. What do you think about this idea?
I think on that part, there is education for the journalist that needs to happen. There aren't many science journalism courses or science journalism schools across North America or even across Europe. And the first time that you go to a scientist, as a journalist, you have to think about where they're coming from and what their world is like to understand what's going on. And with science, it's evidence-based, so the more that... if there's more evidence that leans towards one side of the argument, then that should be happening. But this needs to be brought out in the stories as well, and that needs to be taught to the journalists, that maybe it won't be a 50-50 split. Yes, there's probably going to be two sides, but you have to be conscious of how many scientists across the world are saying yes to this and how many scientists are saying no to this, and put that into the story as well. So it's training on the journalist side of things to understand a little bit of how science works and how it functions.
Great. And we're chatting with Jennifer, whose background is in science journalism. And we've just been talking about some of the conflicts that arise, well, not conflicts, but issues that arrive reporting science in the media. So, Don, go ahead.
I was watching your TED Talk, and I thought there was something interesting, because we haven't really let you talk much about your TED Talk because we've hijacked the conversation at times. But you were talking about some of the things about how you can bring wonder to science reporting, and you were using such things as pictures and analogies and stories and that. You know, tell us more about, you know, in the 5 minutes that's left in our show, how would you solve all of the problems that we've been talking about in the show?
Well, thank you for putting me up to the challenge. I think it's true. I was using other types of media, and I think there was something that you mentioned just before the show started, that appealing to a person's sense of child. Because, I mean, we're all just children at heart, and we just want to know. And I think it's just... I mean, there's so many parts of our day where there's so many things that we have to do, and so many to-do lists, and so many just monotonous things that we have to do, that it's really important to bring in something really exciting and different. And I think there's just so much creativity that can be applied to science. And I think it's fantastic. Like, I came across, I think it was on the Nature News Network, possibly, that I came across it. And they actually were showing the structure of the atom with dogs. Like, it was just completely random. But it was fantastic. I think they were aiming it at an elementary or maybe junior high level.
Maybe they were going for the veterinarian or zoo audience there.
Maybe, yeah. But there was going to be more to come using explaining science with dogs. There's going to be more on this channel. And I think that's just fantastic, because it's one of those things where you can share science, but not necessarily in a way that people recognize that they're being taught science. And I think that's fantastic if you can kind of insert that in there sneakily. I think it's the best thing ever if you can just teach people things, but they don't necessarily realize it's science, because science is everywhere and it completely envelops our entire lives all the time.
So who are some of the popularizers of science that you've found personally inspiring?
Besides our show, of course.
And the Magic School Bus.
Magic School Bus, yeah. Actually, I went back and started reading the Magic School Bus again after not seeing them for so many years, and they're just fantastic. It's that exact same thing where they just sneak the science in. You don't even realize it. My favorite thing that I listen to regularly is actually WNYC's Radiolab. They do a fantastic job. They find these amazing stories. It's two people that put on this show, and they find the stories, but they actually put in a lot of sound effects and music and make the story of real human value. And I listen to a lot of science podcasts, and I think I listened to maybe 5 or 6 of them before I realized it was science, which was just fantastic.
It reminded me a lot of This American Life. That's sort of with a science viewpoint instead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then I've always read Discover magazine. I think they do a really good job. So the writers that write for that, like Carl Sagan,
Everybody loves that. Carl Sagan.
Exactly. and Carl Zimmer and Natalie Andrew. I'm not sure if she writes for that, but she writes books about science, and I really enjoy those people.
Awesome. So,
mm-hmm. Out of curiosity, what do you think of 2012? The movie. Well, I
try to steer away from that because I just think it's kind of ridiculous. So,
yeah. All right.
And this is Dawn reporting from Brandon, Manitoba, with another segment of Ahead of the Curve.
Stay above the flat line. I'm ahead of the curve. Take a piece of the sunshine with me on a red eye flight to another world. It isn't any trouble if you wanna come with me. Stay above the flat line. I'm ahead of the curve. Take a piece of the sunshine with me on an all-night drive to another world.
In this segment of Ahead of the Curve, I'm going to explore a show that I discovered over the holidays called Conspiracy Theory with Jesse Ventura on True TV. Jesse Ventura, for those who don't know, used to be a professional wrestler, apparently was a Marine at one time, famous for an acting career, starring alongside of the likes of Arnold Schwarzenegger. Then, in an odd turn, became governor of Minnesota, where he was known as somewhat of a progressive, disappeared for a while, but has come back to do this TV show. The premise of the show, Jesse and a team of skeptic science investigators look at various conspiracy theories. Now, they have covered a few of the biggies so far. There's only been about 7 episodes, and of those, only 5 have been broadcast. They cover things like 9/11, global warming. They have a future one coming up on Apocalypse 2012. The one I reviewed was the first one in the series on HAARP. H-A-A-R-P. That's the High Frequency Active Aurora Research Program that's going on in Alaska by the American government and military. I'm not going to be looking at HAARP itself or the conspiracies about it, but about the show and how it performs its investigations and whether it's something skeptics should be looking forward to or something they should fear as feeding the hysteria that is already out there. The first thing I noticed when watching the show was its over-the-top drama. It starts off by saying, HAARP, is it a death weapon? Will it destroy the Earth? Is it part of some great conspiracy that can control your mind? They begin with a bit of the history, which is a little weak and a little loose, but they say it was somehow started by Big Oil. Then they go on to say that the government got interested in it and became part of the Star Wars program and for communications with deep submersible subs, part of the whole Cold War arms buildup. And then they go in and they drop in this thing about how it can be used for human mind control. And they mention this, they repeatedly hit this one button a lot during the show, but brought very little evidence for it. In fact, the only evidence they do bring to show that mind control is real is it's their explanation as to why so many conscripted, mistreated, ill-fed Iraqi soldiers gave up during the first Iraqi war. They said at that point they were using the HAARP technology on the battlefield. Now, of course, one must wonder if they had this technology for the first Iraq war, why they haven't used it since, especially in such places as, Iraq 2, Afghanistan. There are numerous areas that if they really had this technology to do this quote-unquote mind control, they would have used it. But no, they kept hitting that button. The images they used were of clinical studies that had nothing to do with HAARP, had nothing to do, I think, even with mind control. I'm not sure where the graphics came from, but they seemed just to be there to add fear and menace to the show, which, again, was something that I didn't like. There was a lot of hype, a lot of hysteria, and not to bring excitement to the show like you would get in Mythbusters. Mythbusters does the same thing, but it's designed to make it exciting. But this just seemed to pump the fear button, to raise anxiety. You were drawn into watching the show, but not for the love of discovery, or even the love of a good blast. Because if you didn't watch it, you might die. Because they went in there, and they provided some evidence. And what was the evidence? Well, they had one of the guys who said that it can move clouds. And they say the way that HAARP works is it heats up the atmosphere and it can do all sorts of things like change the weather, shoot down planes, create seismic waves in the earth. One point where they say that the Indonesia Christmas typhoon was caused by a successful but misapplied HAARP experiment. In the one experiment, as I said, they did with a cloud chamber. Now, the cloud chamber, of course, uses dry ice. Not a lot of dry ice in our atmosphere, so not a very accurate representation, but again, it was designed to show that if you heated an atmosphere, you can move it. And that's true. And they said in there in dramatic, see what we did in this little cloud chamber. It was about 4 feet by 1 foot in diameter. Look, at 100 watts can do this to this little chamber. Could you imagine what HAARP does? And HAARP has a billion watts. Well, being skeptical by nature, I did a few calculations. And the HAARP apparatus is designed to work on the ionosphere. The ionosphere is 85 miles in the air. So a billion watts, the area that it would heat up, worked out to be less than a centimeter. Now let's pretend my math is off. Let's say my math is off by several factors. Well, let's say it could do an area of 85, 100 kilometers. That would have some effect, but it would have nowhere near the effect that they're claiming. Plus, if you heat up the air in northern Alaska, it is not going to make a significant difference to the Gulf Stream or Africa or many other things that they were hinting at would be the effect, but not quite saying. And that was another aspect about the show that I found misleading, is that they hinted that droughts in Africa were caused by HAARP. Flooding could be caused by HAARP. But they never actually provided any evidence, and they just kind of hinted at it. They did interviews with locals, and they made a big aspect about how the locals are afraid to talk. Or maybe they're not afraid. Maybe they just have nothing to say. They had one guy who did talk, and he said that he was in a bar, and he overheard some people talk about mind control. And one of the guys came over and talked to him about how they're doing all this mind control. So again, you sit back and you say, well, if it's such a big conspiracy, why are they talking about it? There was a lot of inconsistencies in the level of research that was done in the show. Another thing that came up was they went in there dramatically. They were wanted to. Jesse Ventura drove up to the front gates of HAARP to investigate the HAARP. He wanted to look at the facilities himself, as if he actually knows anything about electromagnetic experimental apparatus. But he drives up to this military experimental base, knocks on the door, and is surprised that they won't let him in. He says, I'm Jesse Ventura. If you're trying to intimidate me, I don't get intimidated. I get angry. It was this over-the-top thing. And then, and hilariously, they said, well, you know, you can come in for a thing. We have regular tours. Just sign up for the tour. I mean, if it's such a cloak and dagger thing, such a mysterious thing, and they kept saying, ooh, what are they hiding? Are they hiding something? Ooh, it was just very, very inconsistent. It was worse than a waste of time. It only fed the conspiracy theories. Overall, Jesse Ventura's conspiracy theory is a crap show. Be wary of it, because you're going to hear your friends or friends of friends talking about how this show proved the conspiracy of the month or some other quack idea. Not a good show, not recommended. And I'm just giving you all a heads up so that you can be ahead of the curve. I'm ahead of the curve.
We've got Justin Trottier here in from CFI, Canada. And I was noticing in your website that one of the things that was prominent was this campaign for freedom. And I know the idea of free speech, especially when it comes to things like hate crimes and religious intolerance and that type of thing, is kind of a quagmire. What was your group's response to it and advocacy of it?
Well, the Campaign for Free Expression, which late 2009 was turned into a Center for Inquiry priority, it was turned into an international campaign that actually started in Canada about a year ago, and we launched the same thing, the Campaign for Free Expression. And the reason was a number of things on lots of levels. Locally, we had books that were being banned by various Catholic school boards in Toronto at the time. For example, The Golden Compass, which supposedly promoted atheism. The author was an atheist. It's a children's book, a fantasy book, and it turned into a movie, of course. And so that was banned, and we thought that was ridiculous. Of course, these are publicly funded Catholic schools, so you're essentially telling atheists who are funding the school that their sort of worldview is not welcome. Obviously, we had a problem with that. But on the provincial level, as you may know, various human rights commissions and those sorts of institutions were at that time also looking to censor various publishers for offensive things that they were publishing. And the example, big example, is the Mohammed cartoons, which where the publisher of that of the publication that actually produced them in Canada, the Western Standard, was actually essentially bankrupted by having to defend himself at the Alberta Human Rights Commission and Citizenship Commission, whatever it's called. So there, that was happening. And we looked across Canada and we saw that the United Nations every year has been forced to essentially erode the power of the of their special of they have a director called the Special Rapporteur on Free Speech, and he's supposed to monitor abuses of free speech around the world. And his mandate every year gets changed a little bit so that it's kind of eroded from its original emphasis on free speech to a new emphasis on looking for abuses of free speech that essentially criticize religion. So if somebody's criticizing religion, it's no longer seen as protected. It's now potentially an abuse of free speech, which can be, well, I'm not sure how exactly they stop it, but the UN is essentially dictating to countries that a free speech policy, which we think is just completely backwards. So there were all these things happening at the time, and a lot of those issues are still very much alive. And that's what prompted us to launch this. You know, of course, people should be free to practice their religion without threats of violence. But none of this was violence. This was simply criticism. This was simply sarcasm, simply what we feel is protected religious dialogue. And one of the things that makes Canada great is its protection for that value. So, you know, to us, this was important enough to have a major campaign over. And that's why we decided to launch this campaign for free speech. And it was seen as important enough that it became international. And now there's this Blasphemy Day, which is a yearly, well, we hope it's going to be a yearly project of CFI.
Does CFI have specific, I was reading about Professor Moore and his recommendations for altering the Canadian Charter of Laws with regards to hate crime.
That's right.
Your group supports the idea of hate crimes or not?
Yeah, in a certain sense. We support Professor Moore in his recommendation that the Human Rights Act be amended so that only incitement to violence is considered grounds for censorship, rather than the way it's worded right now, where anything that's deemed overly offensive actually could be grounds for censorship. The criminal code actually prohibits hate crime as a criminal offense. So Moore's point was you already have the criminal code, you don't also need to have it in human rights legislation. We agree with that. We think when it comes to human rights legislation, that free speech is the human right that needs protection more than the religious sensibilities, that those are already well protected in the existing criminal code. So we definitely support Moore's the direction Moore wants to go, and we've said that in lots of our speeches.
A minor, perhaps pedantic point, but isn't part of the point of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and that is to protect things that can be, like the criminal code can be edited, and protection against hate crimes can be removed any time.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's enshrined in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, so there is, I mean, you could see a case be made that some form of hate crime protection could be enshrined in the Charter of Rights.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm personally convinced with the necessity for hate crime legislation as such. I mean, I think crime is crime, and I'm not sure that, you know, the fact that it was that it had that motivation necessarily means it should be treated any worse. In a sense, you're privileging a form of crime when the act itself is no different. That's maybe a controversial view, but I feel like if somebody gets punched in the face, it really doesn't matter if it was motivated by the fact that person was Muslim or just the fact that you didn't like how they looked. It's a punch in the face, and the fact that somebody's Muslim, I don't think that should mean that their crime is worse than the fact that the person wasn't Muslim. I mean, a punch is a punch. But I understand that that's, for some reason, controversial, that view of equality. So the CFI position is not necessarily that human rights legislation shouldn't have anything to say about hate crime, but certainly it shouldn't go as far as it does currently, and it goes as far as actually censoring people for being offensive or sarcastic and stuff like that. I mean, that's how it has been used and abused in the by Human Rights Commission. So that is something we want to see modified. And if there's a shell of left that is still a form of censorship, I could live with that. But it definitely needs to be watered down substantially so that human rights commissions, which are not, they're not judges, these are really just activists who run these, they should not have the powers that they currently do to censor offensive things.
Side note too,
the CFI or yourself, we had this debate before, skeptic view versus libertarian view, and your view sounds very libertarian. Is that how you would classify yourself?
Not really. I mean, I have those sensitivities, I guess, but it's complicated. I don't know if we have time to get into it, but there are lots of ways where I'm not a libertarian, especially when it comes to protecting children. Libertarians tend to think that they own children, and I think that children need the same level of protection as adults, and sometimes that means protecting children at the expense of supposedly parental rights. So that's where I do come to odds with a lot of libertarian positions, among others, so I wouldn't call myself that. But maybe on this issue, you know, about human rights law, I'm not sure. I don't have a degree in political philosophy, but maybe I'd be a libertarian there.
In the sense that anyone can easily be classified into any political affiliation.
Yeah, I mean, like you probably would say that CFI is not a libertarian organization.
No, not at all. I mean, CFI, you're asking me these questions off the cuff, so I'm just telling you my personal answers, but I should be strictly acknowledge that CFI does not have any partisan ideology politically, nor is it libertarian or socialist or anything like that. And its members are extremely diverse, especially and its staff is also just as diverse. So it makes it fun working there, actually.
Well, Justin, I know time's running down and you got to get running, but suppose somebody heard this interview and loves the idea of CFI and wants to help. How can they go about doing that?
Yeah, well, I guess the best way is to visit our website. Some of them are more active than others, but they all have contact information. So if you go to cficanada.ca, you'll see email addresses and phone numbers, and you can get involved there. If you're local in Vancouver, look up the CFI Vancouver groups. There's a meetup group called Skeptics in the Pub, which is associated with us. If you're interested in getting together socially to talk about skepticism, there's a lecture series we put on that you can, it's public, everybody's invited to attend. There are campus groups. If you're at UBC or SFU or the University of the Fraser Valley, I know we have groups at those campuses. But if you're at another campus, help us start a group. Contact me. My email address is justin.trottier, last name, T-R-O-T-T-I-E-R @gmail.com, and I can point you in whatever direction you want to be pointed in.
Excellent.
This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob saying have a good evening.
And this is Daniel saying we love all of our viewers.
Viewers.
The best tool ever devised for understanding how the world works.
Science is a vacuum for knowledge. We are always at the brink of the known.
Science is a collaborative enterprise spanning the generations.
We remember those who prepared the way, seeing through them all suffering.
If you're scientifically literate, the world looks very different to you, and that understanding empowers you.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
We can do science, and with it, we can improve our lives.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
The story of humans is a story of ideas that shine light into dark corners.
Scientists love mysteries. They love not knowing.
I don't feel frightened by not knowing things. I think it's much more interesting.
There's a larger universal reality of which we are all a part.
The further we probe into the universe, the more remarkable are the discoveries we make.
The quest for the truth in and of itself is a story that's filled with insights.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
We can do science, and with it, we can improve our lives.
There's real poetry in the real world.
Science is the poetry of reality.
The story of humans is the story of ideas that shine light into dark corners.
From our lonely point in the cosmos, we have, through the power of thought, been able to peer back to a brief moment after the beginning of the universe.
I think that science changes the way your mind works, to think a little more deeply about things.
Science replaces private prejudice with publicly verifiable evidence. There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
We can do science, and with it, we can improve our lives.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
Book the date. On March 28th and 29th, celebrate the UBC Bookstore's new space. Join the new release party. On March 28th, enjoy breakfast with free coffee followed by UBC Bhangra, Poetry Slam, the Thunderbird Dance Team, Missy D and Lady Jams, and UBC Acapella. On March 29th, enjoy music, giant games, face painting, balloon twisting, and kids authors. There will be free food throughout both days, prizes, giveaways, and discounts. Take part in MEC's spin class, backpacking talk, and run clinics for free. The first 50 guests receive a $20 gift card on March 28th, and the first 20 customers receive a $10 gift card on March 29th. For more information, go to bookstore.ubc.ca, and don't forget to book the date.
Oh,
tell you one thing, ain't gonna change much. Sun still rises, even with the pain. Tell you one thing, ain't gonna change, love. The sun still rises, even through the rain.